If you want this podcast free of ads, follow us now on patreon.com/David McWilliams.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
What in the world is happening on Wall Street?
Economic indicators.
Who knows where this is going to end up?
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you doing there? It is podcast time. John, how are you?
I am very good. Very good indeed.
Are you re-acclimatized now that you've...
I have still...
From the frozen north.
I still have a yearning to be back there, up in the top of mountains and down in the depths of fjords and, oh man.
It sounds great. Next time. Take me. To annoy you, can you imagine? What is that doing?
Puffing and puffing, trying to get up a mountain.
Exactly. Hey, listen, I'm not the chain smoker in this relationship. Anyway, so you've just the feet on the ground.
Feet on the ground. Come here. I was thinking the other day, you know, we were talking about Evergrande.
In China, yeah.
In China. And they had a big payment due last week.
Which they missed.
And I was thinking, it reminded me of way back in the 80s when my brother and Fergus Mann and a few of those heads were renting a house in Stanmore.
I love, where's this going? And where is Stanmore in London?
Stanmore is way up north, west London, is it?
Okay.
It's basically at the end of the Jubilee line.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
the cheapest area you can get in the Jubilee line.
Yeah, exactly. And they were sitting there watching the telly one night, you know, five lads in a rented house. And of course they had missed their payment on their telly. And there was a ring at the door. Bing bong. Someone went and opened the door. A couple of lads just came in, burst open the door, lifted up the telly as they were watching it, lifted up the telly, yanked the plug out of the wall and walked out.
Repo men.
And I was thinking, why didn't that happen in China?
Well, it might happen in China.
Oh, really?
This is the interesting thing. Well, actually, did you ever see the movie Repo Man? Emilio Estevez?
No, but do you know my cousin was a repo man with airplanes? He used to fly into places and basically
break... Rob the planes.
Take the planes, yeah, hotwire them. He'd bring a pilot with him who would hotwire the plane. And he's got amazing stories. But he did one in Colombia and they hotwired and they were shooting down the runway. And the lads came out with guns, started...
Really? Well, I tell you, we've gone into the very, very pernicious area of bankruptcy and what happens when a company goes bankrupt and who has the first rights to the assets and who has the last rights to the assets. What sort of creditor are you? Now, it's interesting you mentioned this idea of repoing a plane, right? Because there is a fund in the United States, a real vulture fund, because that's what real vulture funds do, is they're the repo men of the financial sector, right? They come in when the carcass is rotting of the company and they pick the best bits and they leave. That's why they're called vulture funds.
Yeah.
The company is called Elliott and Associates. And Elliott and Associates has basically spearheaded this idea since the 70s. And their stock and trade was doing exactly that for third world countries that had defaulted.
Taking their tellies,
in effect, yeah. Look, impounding their aircraft, impounding bits of their navy, extraordinary stuff.
Really?
And trying to sell it on the open market. And China... This is the interesting thing. So the American way of dealing with bankruptcy traditionally has been the repo man.
Mm.
That the company goes bust. It's a limited liability company. So its liability is limited. And the bits that are left in the company, the carcass, the repo man goes in and buys at 4 cents in the dollar, 3 cents in the dollar, 10 cents in the dollar, and then tries flogging them off in the secondary market. That's actually how it works. Interesting thing in China. Evergrande is bust. it's very clear to me that it's much less significant what happens in that company, and it's much more significant what it says about the system, right? Because we've said it before, the Yanks have this expression about cockroaches, you never see one, you see 100. So if you come in, you've got a cockroach in your apartment in New York, you know it's not just one.
Yeah.
When bankruptcy happens in property markets that are heavily leveraged, right, it's always a canary in the coal mine, okay? It's always just one, but it's masking many dozens of equally bust companies.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, the question is for us, is we'll talk about China in a minute, is do the Chinese adopt the American approach traditionally, which is basically allow the companies go bust, or do the Central Bank of China intervene and keep these companies limping on, right? Now, my own sense is the Chinese will intervene for a variety of reasons, one of which their property market is too big to fail. For them, or they feel it's too big to fail.
We keep hearing that phrase. We've always heard that phrase, yeah, but yeah, you know, too big to fail. Is that really true, though?
Well, I'll give you, there are 90 million. This gives you a sense of how ruined the Chinese property market is, how appalling it has been, how malinvestment is all over the place. 90 million empty apartments in China.
Jesus.
That's more than there are
really?
People in Germany. Right.
Wow.
Okay. This is
could
the,
they
this
not
is,
just
this is the
know,
oversupply.
Tip one of those apartment blocks on its side and ship it over here.
Well, your grasp of engineering, John.
Oh no, I'm sure it can be done. I'm sure it can be done. There's an app for that.
There's an app. No, but seriously. So the 90 million, right? We think our house prices are excessively high, and they are. But in China, it's extraordinary. The ratio of house prices to income is now 18 times. In Ireland,
wow,
it's 6 or 7.
Jesus.
Right.
Okay. Right.
So we're talking about a massive, massive property bubble, like massive, massive, massive on a monumental scale. And everybody should be aware of this, because what happened in China was, and it always happens, and I'm going to compare it to Japan in a second, but there's always a movement or a moment where policy changes in a country. After the 2008 crash, the Americans realized that the only country left standing was China. America was bust, Europe was bust,
yeah,
right? And they persuaded the Chinese to pivot their economy away from exports and into domestic consumption. So they said to the Chinese, you can no longer base your growth strategy on exporting to us because we're in a recession. And longer term, in order to rebalance the world economy, we need China to do a little more of the heavy lifting at home. Right?
How do you do that, though? How do you?
There's lots of communiques. And also we forget, right? We forget that the world in 2008 was a much more globalized world. It was much better relationships between all
true.
The powers. Much better relationships, right? The world now is not like that. That's why America and China have fallen out. And the last Biden-Xi summit, it was an appalling, appalling summit, right? The Yanks and the Chinese almost screaming at each other. But back then, there was much more sense
really?
Of cooperation. Oh, yeah. The relationships between America and China have really gone off
You'd
the
deep end. You'd love to be a fly on the wall in those meetings.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. But let's come back to the idea, right? Massive, massive shift in Chinese policy about 12 years ago. They said, okay, we will fuel the engine of growth domestically. How will we do that? We will start lending to real estate. Why did they start lending to real estate? Because real estate has this thing called the wealth effect, that as your house prices rise, you feel richer and you take on more debt because you feel, well, hold on a second, my balance sheet looks okay because my house is worth twice of what it was last year. Therefore, I can take on twice as
this
much debt.
This was Ireland 2005,
yeah,
2006. Yeah.
Yeah. You go all the way back, railway shares, go back to the South
right,
Sea bubble,
yeah,
go back to all sorts of speculative manias. They're all based on the same idea of your balance sheet playing tricks on you. That what looks good objectively is subjectively a disaster. So objectively, it looks, everything looks fine, but
yeah,
you're taking on more and more debt. So, of course, because China is a state-run country, the state-run banks were at the vanguard of this, right? So they would go and borrow from the Chinese central bank. They would then lend out to Chinese people. Chinese people would buy the apartments that the developers were building. And you get to this crazy situation where they have 90 million oversupply in China. Right. And oversupply is always the case that they built apartments in the wrong place.
Yeah.
At the wrong price for the wrong people.
Yeah, we were talking the other day about how they were blowing up. Was it 5 apartment blocks?
Yeah.
Massive apartment
well,
blocks.
Just think in the Irish context of our ghost estates, you know, big, big estates and outside towns in Roscommon that nobody was ever going to live in, right? Yeah. Same idea. So you get this huge oversupply, and then that creates a dilemma, because how do you deflate a property bubble without imploding the balance sheet of the companies and the people involved? So it's a very, very hard thing to do, and it has to take 10 or 11 years to be able to try and do this, right? During this period, this is the problem, is one or two of those heavily leveraged companies will begin to run out of money, right? And the reason they begin to run out of money is that they're borrowing all this money in order to invest in property. If there's any sort of wobble in the property market, any sort of income drying up, okay, what basically happens is that company begins to have difficulties paying its debts. But much more interestingly is that once a company begins to bleed in a bubble, right, everybody who ever lent money to that company thinks, oh shit, let's get in the front of the queue and demand. So what happens is credit cycles, when things are going great, your maturity tends to be very long. So you can borrow for somebody, say, I'll give you that back in 5 years' time, right? Or in 10 years' time, right? And if your balance sheet looks okay, that's fine. But once people begin to panic, right, suddenly everybody who's a creditor says, no, I want my money back today. And your credit lines shrink dramatically and your maturity shrink dramatically. This is how companies go bust, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So this is, I believe, what is happening deep within the Chinese firmament, like very, very deep. And of course, the Chinese Communist Party is putting a brave face in it. And what they're saying is, it's only one bad egg. So they're saying Evergrande is uniquely delinquent. That is never the case. It's never the case, it's only one bad egg. It's a bit like in Ireland, they said, oh, it was only Anglo was bad. Yeah. Every single Irish bank was bust.
Yeah.
Every single one needed a bailout, right? It wasn't just Anglo. And of course, what happens is because all the banks lent to each other, suddenly, when all the banks started saying,
it's a cascading effect.
It's a cascading effect. It's exactly like, if you ever see the image, I would think of credit is, and you like this because you're into nature, right? Do you know the way, if you ever watch in the Kalahari Desert, right?
Yeah.
When the rains come in, right? And the rains begin to spread across and there's all verdant life.
Yeah,
and
springs
into action, and you get all these wildebeest coming and hanging out there in this kind of marsh. And then gradually the rains recede and it gets hot and the water evaporates. And very, very soon, what looked like a big lake ends up looking like a puddle.
Yeah.
That's exactly how credit behaves in the economy. In good times, it's everywhere. In bad times, it's nowhere. So that's where I think we are at in China. And what is critical is to understand that for the global economy, China has been two things. It has been the huge, huge dynamo of growth for commodities, for all sorts of countries that take things out of the ground and sell, right?
Yeah.
And it's been a source of enormous, enormous manufacturing prowess for all of Asia. If the Chinese economy follows the path of the Japanese economy, okay, if what is happening now in China is what happened in the 1980s, late 1980s in Japan, we're in for a huge shock to the system in Asia. And because Asia is the only part of the global economy that has been really growing rapidly, can you imagine the ramifications for the rest of the world? So that's what we're going to focus on today.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Okay, Mark, just before we move on to Japan, because I'm curious about that. What if the Chinese economy, given the fact that it's so centralized, what if they adopted an MMT-type policy?
I think they will. I think they will adopt an MMT-type policy.
Oh, right.
And I think the MMT is actually, if you think about it, MMT is the monetary policy of communist states. So if you imagine the Soviet Union many years ago, the Soviet Union just printed money. They printed rubles.
Yeah.
And they printed rubles. But the problem was the Soviet economy, and this is always the problem with inflation, right, is that printing money is not a problem as long as your economy is sufficiently flexible and has got the huge supply side capacity in order to actually sell goods to you.
Okay.
So basically the money isn't chasing fewer goods, it's chasing the same amount of goods. In the Soviet Union, what happened in the Soviet Union was basically ended up being a delinquent petrol state. You know, so that's all it was. And it used to hope and pray for increases in the price of oil in order to finance itself internally, right? Which is why you could argue that in the 1970s, the increase in the oil price as a result of the Arab-Israeli wars was a complete godsend to the communists in the Soviet Union because it gave them another 10 years of revenue. So MMT, they will do something like this, and I think they will intervene, right? And they will try as much as possible to prevent a banking stroke property stroke credit collapse, right? Will they be successful? My sense is no, that it's very, very difficult, even if you're the size of China, to manage these things. And even if you do manage it, the ramifications of falling real estate prices on Chinese wealth and the Chinese sense of security will be profound. So the economy will go into recession anyway.
But it's amazing that they didn't see this coming.
Well,
and how they let it get so far.
Do you remember last week we were talking to Dan Ariely?
Yeah.
And he was talking about when people are incredibly committed to an idea, whether that's aliens or real estate.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
No, it's not that they don't see it coming. They can't bring themselves to see it coming because they understand that the consequence of being wrong is so apocalyptic. And they've devoted so much of their effort. So if you're sitting in the Politburo, you're thinking, okay, our promise to the Chinese people used to be, we will make you all equal. That was the Mao promise. Then with Xi Jinping is, we will make you all rich. So that was the whole promise. You know, we don't care how you get there, but we're going to increase living standards, right? If you can't make your people rich through real estate, which was in effect what they were doing, then the social contract between the Communist Party and the people has broken down. Now, it's not to say the Communist Party is going anywhere. Of course not. As we said last week, China is a country with a 3,000-year centralized government history.
Yeah.
It's not going anywhere quickly.
Yeah.
But be that as it may, the ramifications of a property crash in China are really significant. And what I find fascinating are the parallels with Japan.
So tell us about Japan. What is the Japanese story then?
Well, the Japanese story is absolutely fascinating. Do you remember we did a podcast years ago on the Meiji Restoration?
Meiji, yes. Yeah, I do actually.
Yeah. And the Meiji Restoration was this extraordinary change in Japanese economic, social, legal policy and a massive change in what it meant to be Japanese.
What year are we talking?
1867, 1868.
Yeah.
And of course, it was in reaction to something that happened in China. So when the Brits imposed the Opium War on the Chinese and blockaded Chinese ports in the 1850s, the Japanese looked at that and said, okay, the reason China, despite its huge size, has been laid low and belittled by these Westerners is that technologically China is backward. And the Japanese looked at themselves, they said, technologically, we are backward too. And what actually prompted the total freak out was the arrival of two US naval ships uninvited into Tokyo Harbor in 1867.
Right.
And the reason the Americans were there is that the Americans had just kicked the Mexicans out of California, right?
Yes, yeah.
And
yeah.
Therefore, the Americans had a Pacific coast that they had to protect. They'd never had that before.
Yeah.
Think of it, we forget about that. So in order to do that, to build up the Pacific fleet, which is the one that the Japanese attacked in Pearl Harbor, the same one,
yeah,
except the antecedent of this. And they were kind of mooching around the Pacific, you know, sticking their nose in.
Yeah, looking for something to do.
Yeah, looking for trouble. And of course, the Japanese understood two things. One is they were technologically backward. And two, they have no energy.
Right,
so Japan and Germany are quite similar in many, many ways. But from an economic perspective, is both of them have no energy. So they are carbon burners on a monumental scale. They basically, Japan and Germany turn fossil fuels into cars.
Yes.
That's what they do, right? So the Meiji Restoration is when the Japanese said, unless we become technologically better than the Westerners, they will do to us what they've done to China.
Right.
So this extraordinary, mad change of the society from the top down. And from the top down matters to what I'm going to talk about. Because at its core, real estate speculation, at its very, very core, is the extreme form of Western capitalism. Western capitalism based on Adam Smith, it's about the individual, it's about the liberalization of markets, it's about the market, it's about the invisible hand, the market can't be wrong.
Yeah.
So ultimately, speculation is something that the Japanese and to a degree the Chinese, but certainly the Japanese, look down their nose at. So the Japanese economy has always prided itself in being a collective idea. And the Japanese have always looked down their nose on this idea of the rational man making economic decisions a la Adam Smith. And they've always thought, and actually I'll give you the terms in Japanese, right?
Yeah.
There's a Japanese worldview which is called Nihon Jinron. I'm not sure if the pronunciation is right.
But it's convincing. You shouldn't have said that. Keep going.
We could do our fake Japanese accents.
No, don't.
That we
no,
get...
no, no, no.
But then we get cancelled.
Yeah.
That's the Pavlovian response of a Canadian millennial to an Irish idiot just about to put on a Japanese accent.
Yeah.
Okay. But that's loosely translated as Japan is unique, right? That the Japanese believe that they are different. So much so that in the 1980s, they used to make the claim that Japanese intestines were different to Westerners and
what?
Japanese brains were different to Westerners. All this mad stuff, right?
Yeah.
But they have these really fascinating ideas, right?
Well, I'll tell you one thing about Japanese culture and the Japanese way is I did a lot of work in Japan as a recording engineer. There was one guy I worked with, a guy called Aichi Izawa. And
I'm liking him already.
He was a huge star in Japan. We worked with him in London and Aichi said one day, got a great idea for a solo. And he jumped on the keyboard and he started doing this solo. And I looked around at George and went, this is crap. And he goes, leave it. It's actually good. And it's interesting that he was listening and hearing melodies in a completely different way. And if you look at Japanese and indeed Chinese traditional music instruments, there's no bass. There's no bass instruments at all.
Really?
So there is a different way
of listening, of hearing.
Yeah.
So they could be right.
Yeah.
That Japan is unique.
Possibly.
Okay. They also, like, listen, we will go with that because they also have this idea called wa, which means social harmony. Okay. And this is essential to the Japanese way of thinking, right? And underscoring that is a distrust of individualism, which is why Japanese people tend to be very respectful of authority.
Yeah.
They take orders because this idea of social harmony is culturally very, very important to them, right? So you take that as a different philosophy on the world. Back to your idea of maybe they listen to music differently. They don't use basses, all that sort of stuff. And, you know, I presume the bass is kind of central to our music.
Yeah, yeah.
So their idea was that they could never, ever really end up speculating on real estate. It would be completely out of character for them. So just take that as our starting point. They end up with the biggest property bubble, boom, bust, collapse ever seen. Ever seen. So the question is, what happened? If you take Japanese philosophy and Japanese history, which has been subservient to central control, and the individual should always be frugal and you should play down your wealth, and you should never be flashy because that upsets social harmony, then how in the late 80s did they get to a situation where the land upon which the Imperial Palace was built in Tokyo was worth more than the entire real estate of California?
What? Okay? Really?
Of California.
Jesus.
Right? So how does that happen? So you've got to go back. And the reason, again, keep looking at the parallels between China and Japan. Japan has this phenomenal post-war record of growth. The economy grew between 8 and 10% every year from the destruction at Nagasaki in 1945.
That's something that always made me curious was, how come Japan rebounded so quickly after the Second World War?
Very good question. And how come Germany rebounded so quickly? Yeah. So I don't think enough thought has gone into this, right? The Americans under McKinnon, so the Americans, you know, this greatest generation of Americans, the Americans who came up with the Marshall Aid Plan, they had this extraordinary internal policy called adult supervision. So the Americans would be the adults in the playground. Now listen, right. All the rest of the world had to be supervised. This is fascinating stuff, right? They also did something extraordinary. The Americans treated their enemies better after the Second World War than they treated their allies. So why was that?
Okay. Go on, tell us.
It's really interesting. So for example, after the Second World War, the Americans got the Brits to pay back all the money that the Brits had borrowed for them to fight the war.
Oh, right.
They wiped all the debts of Germany, right? Think about it. If you're British, you're kind of thinking, hold on a second. The way the Americans treated the French, who were their allies, were incredibly hostile and vice versa all the way through.
Yeah.
That the Americans took the Versailles Treaty seriously. They took the mistakes that were made after the First World War very seriously. The Brits and the French really never did. So the Americans said, okay, the two countries that are the biggest threat to us are Japan and Germany. And they will remain a threat as long as they are economically underperforming.
Right.
So the Americans, can you believe the Americans had a stipulation in the Marshall Plan that American companies had to buy a certain percentage of German goods and Japanese goods, right? So they actually took these economies that they had destroyed by carpet bombing and they limped them back to health. And they ensured that both of these economies grew much quicker than everybody else. And both of these societies would be indebted to the United States.
So there wasn't taking away the reason
for aggression.
Yeah.
They realized that Germany and Japan had an extraordinarily sophisticated military infrastructure by the time they were fighting. And all countries, if you look at the history of all economics, all great technology tends to come from the military.
Yeah,
the internet came from the military, right?
Yeah.
Lots of the bits of the iPhone come from the military. So the military, anything that a state puts enormous amounts of resources, money and brain power into outwitting its neighbours, into outfoxing its neighbours, is usually going to be extremely beneficial in commercial life after a war.
Yeah,
and the Americans understood this. So they understood that the Brits and the French didn't have that technology that the Germans had. They didn't have that industrial prowess or the Japanese. But what they did, and I don't think the West really appreciated that, is that they favoured their enemies over their allies because they could count on their allies. They knew that the Brits and the French and Western Europe weren't going to threaten them in any way.
Yeah.
But Germany, hold on a second, this is different. And it's exactly the same in Asia. So they preferenced the Japanese. They gave them technology. They gave them transfers. They gave them free loans. They gave them everything to rebuild their economy. And therefore, you see this extraordinary performance, which is Japan is destroyed after the Second World War. By 1968, that's not so long after the Second World War, it was the second largest economy in the world.
Yeah.
And what was the third?
Extraordinary.
Germany. Right. West Germany.
Yeah.
Right? So the Americans had a plan, and that plan was to make sure that their former enemies were treated better than their former friends, which if you're a former friend of America, you might get a little bit pissed off.
Yeah.
So Japan is this extraordinary... I'm going to go through some figures here, right? So Japan is this amazing economy, right? Yeah. It grows unbelievably quickly. But all the brands, the Sonys, Toshibas, all the ones we know, right?
Yeah.
Toyotas, Datsuns, the whole thing, right?
Datsuns, yeah, Jesus. Do you remember them?
Love a Datsun. Love a Datsun. My auntie had a Datsun. Great car. Brown, big brown Datsun. But so 25 years after the Second World War, it's now the second biggest economy in the world. Its export-led growth was extraordinary. The country's exports expanded at a rate of 15% throughout the 60s and 70s.
Right.
up until the oil crash. Okay. Yeah. Amazing, amazing, right? The trade balance with the United States was in deficit in the 1960s. It was a surplus of $10 billion by 1978, of $60 billion by 1987, and $81 billion by 2000.
Wow.
So they have a huge trade surplus with the world. And of course, what they did with this money was they bought American treasuries. So they again started to play this game against the Yanks. They said, okay, well, what we'll do is we will keep buying the debt of the American government, which allows them to continue growing and which allows them to continue buying our stuff. So
right.
They bought market share in the long term, even though in the short term they were losing money. The Chinese did exactly the same.
Right.
So now the Japanese are still the biggest holders of American debt and the Chinese are second, right? What are they doing that for? Because everyone say, why would you invest in a country where the rate of interest is low, lower than yours?
Yeah.
Because they're buying market share, right? They're making sure the Americans keep spending. So that's the thinking behind it. But also you think in terms of the structure of both of these economies. Japan was a very agricultural country before the Second World War, quite a feudal state in the agrarian sense, right? The share of population living in urban areas in Japan surged from just 20% in 1945. Okay, so 80% were agricultural to 64% today. So you've this massive shift, urbanization, right? And exactly the same thing happened in China. So agriculture fell in Japan from 20% of total output to 10%. Right. China, the same sort of figure, from 20% in 1993 to 10% now. So if you look at the Japanese growth rate from 1945 to 1990, when they crashed, and you mirror that with the Chinese growth rate from 1990 to now, it's almost identical.
Right. Wow. It's,
society is becoming much more urban.
Yeah.
It's becoming much richer. It's creating all sorts of amazing companies. It's galvanizing the huge intellectual and financial strength of its people. And it's doing it all with American blessing, right? Because the Americans, remember, they took the Chinese into the G7, into the G8.
Yeah.
They allowed them to join the World Trade Organization, all these things. And the Chinese said, great. But then, and this is where the event happens, the event that changed China, as I said before, was in 2008, 2009, the Americans persuaded them to shift from export growth to domestic growth. Exactly the same thing happened in Japan in 1987. There was a thing called the Plaza Accord, which was an exchange rate mechanism between America, West Germany and Japan. And the Americans persuaded the Japanese to do exactly the same. What they said to the Japanese was keep your interest rates low, expand your economy. By keeping your interest rates low, it'll bring down the price of the yen. That'll push up the price of the dollar. This is what we want.
Right,
the Japanese
right,
said,
right.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
They said, okay. But you reduce interest rates at a time when the economy is booming. And to use the great expression, Bertie Ahern, the boom gets boomier. in Bertie's fantastic language, right? So they fueled this extraordinary and completely out of character real estate boom in Japan. So just to give you an example of how mad this was, Tokyo property was selling in 1988 for 350 times more per square meter than New York property.
Wow.
Right?
I remember though at that time, you know, where and golf membership and everything went through the roof, and they driving ranges on the top of buildings and everything. It was just a crazy kind of...
One of the best leading indicators was the price of golf club membership in Japan. So the place...
I was over there in, I think it was 1990.
So just at the crash, when the crash. But it would have still felt like a boom town in 1990 because it was still...
Yeah, it did, very much so.
Bit like Ireland, you know, still, even though the Celtic Tiger thing probably peaked about 2006.
Yeah.
It's still in 2007. It was still feeling, you know, that everything was hunky-dory. So what you have is a massive shift in the economy away from exports into real estate. Real estate is always and everywhere a wealth destroyer because it leads to people feeling richer, people getting into more debt. And because of the very nature of humanity, that we get giddy and excited and all that sort of stuff, right? The psychology of crowds comes in once we start in these sort of manias, right? It's the psychology of crowds. And everybody convinces themselves that everything's going to be fine.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
The usual stuff, right?
Yeah.
And of course, one of the great leading indicators as well is not just golf club memberships, which went through the roof here, right? Yeah. But also when the people who are experiencing the boom start to buy trophy assets abroad. So do you remember like all the Paddy's started buying the Ritz and the in London and they're putting Irish flags up on this and half Dubai.
Claridge's,
all that sort of thing. Do you remember all that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
This was part of a movement of sort of expansion. The Japs did exactly the same. They bought Columbia Pictures. They bought the Rockefeller Center in New York. They bought the Exxon building in New York. These are totemic jewels for America.
Yeah.
And the Japanese bought them all. And what you tend to find is that all these things, even though they're different in terms of their underlying, they all end up kind of looking the same, these booms, right? And of course, what happened in Japan was the boom, a bit like Evergrande, suddenly one or two companies look a bit dodgy.
Suddenly
they're a bit overexposed, they have too much debt. Exactly the same thing that happened to developers here. They went from being rich guys to being bankrupt in a matter of months, right?
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's the entire fight for survival where everybody's scrambling for cash. And what happened in Japan was Japan went into what they call a balance sheet recession for about 15 years. The economy hardly grew. So having grown 8, 9, 10% for 40 years, it started to grow at 1, 2%, maybe less.
Yeah.
And that became the norm. Why? Because the balance sheet of the country was totally destroyed as a result of the collapse in property prices. Exactly the same thing happened here. The problem with all these things is that people's perception of their wealth gets tied up with property, right?
Yeah.
It's estimated that 70% of the wealth of urban Chinese households is in real estate, right? Number one. Mm-hmm. Because house prices are so expensive, you get an intergenerational mortgages in China. So you take out a mortgage for your kids.
Right.
So two or three generations buy the flat because one can't because the prices are so high. It's exactly the same thing as happened in Japan, right? So if that sort of market collapses, or if it even if property prices begin to fall gradually, the wealth effect is dramatic on the local people because the local people have all bought into property as being the asset of choice. So if you look at what happened in Japan, these parallels are striking with China, even down to population dynamics. The Japanese population peaked in 1994, just at the beginning of this long crash.
Yeah.
So this crash started in 1989, 1990, right? When is the Chinese population going to peak? In 3 years' time.
Oh,
so
right.
You have exactly the same population dynamics. And this is what happens. If you've got a balance sheet recession and a population that's falling, this can go on for a long, long time.
So you're saying the long-term outlook of Evergrande is China's just going to go into a long recession.
A long balance sheet recession. And
which could last 10, 20 years?
Well, the way in which you get out of recessions quickly is either you try to hive off your debt to somebody else or you refinance all those bad loans and you kick it out into the future. Or you go through what they call a grinding balance sheet recession, or a combination of all three is much more likely.
Right.
So it's not just one or other. It seems to me that, and I come back to the point, Evergrande is not important. It's what it's saying about the system is profoundly important.
Yeah.
In the same way as individual Japanese banks, Daiwa, all these banks, which were huge banks in the 80s, became small banks. But the fact that they became small wasn't the issue. It was the Japanese system, which had leveraged itself to real estate, completely out of character with the Japanese previous philosophy of wa and all these things I was talking about and social harmony, cost the Japanese about two generations of economic growth.
Wow.
And exactly the same thing could happen in China.
So what then, if China moves into this lagging period for the next while, what will that mean for the global economy?
Well, I mean, it's huge. The main thing is almost psychological, that almost in our entire adult life, John, China and the Chinese story has been one of growth, right? China growing. Oh my God, it's coming out of nowhere, blah, 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 right? That happened in the early 80s. They kicked it off with Deng Xiaoping and it's been growing ever since. If that background noise changes, that China is now limping, China is now a patient, is no longer this muscular,
yeah,
thrusting economy, but it's patient and it's lagging, the whole psychology of the global economy changes profoundly. And in terms, and we'll leave it here, in terms of actually what will happen is, take a country like Germany. Germany exports, yeah, between 2 and 3% of its GDP to China every year, which is phenomenal.
Yeah.
So actually Mrs. Merkel bet the house on China, bet the German house on China. This will have a profound effect on German exports. This will slow down the German economy. It will therefore reduce any upward pressure on interest rates in Europe. And the long-term or medium-term impact of this will be lower interest rates for countries like Ireland. This means that we should be taking this opportunity to refinance everything, number one, as I've said before, take advantage of these low interest rates, but also, number two, to get on with any capital projects we want by issuing long-term bonds, availing of the fact that interest rates will remain low because the Chinese are on their knees. And this seems to me to be the implication for us. Fix the infrastructure, fix the train system, fix the transport system, and fix the housing system, and do it with money that would have been otherwise more expensive had it not been for this coming Chinese property crash. I'd like to thank all our Patreon supporters, because without you, this wouldn't be possible. So thank you all very, very much. And we have a little treat for you coming up. We have a new online course. We have a new entire podcast, Monetary Economics course. I mean, monetary economics at the moment is so important. And we have a fantastic course. We're just finishing it. It's going to be with you next Tuesday. So that's the new David Buck-Williams Monetary Economics course online. And if you want to play, become a Patreon.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.